Well, it's time to rejoin Admiral Cunningham, and we're doing so as autumn turns into winter in 1941 over in the Mediterranean. Now, although on land Operation Battle Axe had failed, a brand new offensive was being prepared, and Cunningham, along with the other senior commanders, was somewhat alarmed that some bright spark in London had decided that if this offensive was successful, they would then immediately send a bunch more troops to the area and invade Sicily. And London wanted the Mediterranean fleet to make a plan to support that. Quite how catastrophic a defeat the Axis would have to suffer to move the situation from "we need to resupply to Brooke by sea because it's under siege" to "we have complete and total control of the entire North African coast" in a matter of months was quite the thought. But luckily, whoever had that particular idea presumably had their access to writing material removed and possibly was locked away in an asylum, and the proposed assault on Sicily, codenamed Whipcord, was cancelled at the end of October. But due to the need for all available aircraft to concentrate on the land offensive rather than supporting the navy, the big ships of the Mediterranean fleet had to remain quiet for now. Although, on the lower end of things, the minelayer Abdiel and a small flock of destroyers were kept very busy making repeated supply runs to Tobruk and also to Cyprus, rotating troops in and out, as well as taking more mundane food, ammunition and spare parts in. There was also coordination to sort out with Malta, as during the last convoy run, the light cruisers Aurora and Penelope, along with the destroyers Lance and Lively, had been sent from the UK to Malta. And within a couple of weeks of arriving, Force K, as it was dubbed, had intercepted two Italian supply convoys that were in the process of joining up, and they ended up sinking seven of the merchant ships and one of the destroyers that was escorting them, with two more destroyers damaged, one of which would be finished off by the submarine Upholder while in tow back to Italy. However, this was somewhat balanced by the loss of Ark Royal over on the other side of the Mediterranean thanks to a U-boat's torpedo. And with that said, the efforts of Force K, as well as submarines and aircraft based in Malta, did manage to cause major supply issues for the Axis, as many of the supply ships were sunk, and the Regia Mariner was forced to sail convoys with extremely heavy escorts in the form of both heavy cruisers and large numbers of destroyers, all of which burned large amounts of oil, which the Regia Mariner was rather quickly running short of. The Axis forces tried to respond to this predation on their supplies by increasing bombing efforts against Malta as 1941 turned into 1942, which would stretch the aerial defences quite thin as attrition gradually whittled down the fighters on the island, which of course necessitated constant reinforcement. Meanwhile, the land offensive we mentioned earlier had been launched, requiring still more efforts by the fleet to keep supplies moving, since crucial logistical elements like water, for example, which tends to be rather heavy and in very high demand, were best moved along by ships rather than trucks, and offensive operations used fresh water far, far faster than static defensive stances. The appearance of a wave of U-boats, which had obviously been heralded by the loss of Ark Royal, didn't help matters either. The large landing ship, formerly ocean liner HMS Glenroy, was torpedoed on a supply run, although she was able to be beached and would later be salvaged. But HMAS Parramatta was less lucky, being torpedoed and sunk. But in so doing, she did shield the ammunition ship SS Han, which thus managed to make it into Tobruk. London, however, decided to stick its oar in once again, claiming, apropos of almost nothing, that the Regia Aeronautica and Luftwaffe forces were now fully occupied in the land campaign, and thus the Mediterranean fleet should sail its entire strength to blockade Benghazi and prevent further supplies reaching it, since there was now no longer an air threat to them. Cunningham's men and ships, meanwhile, who were actually sailing along the coast regularly, reported there was no real relaxation of enemy air attacks on them, and Cunningham was forced to find yet another way of politely asking the First Sea Lord to get the politicians to shut up and stop trying to micromanage him from the other side of the continent. An alternative suggestion was taken up instead. A total of five cruisers, Ajax, Neptune, Naiad, Euryalus, and Galatea, along with four destroyers, were termed Force B, and these were sent out to hit enemy convoys heading to Benghazi. The idea being that Force B and Force K would alternate, one on the offensive while the other one was refueling and rearming, thus providing constant coverage for the assault on the convoys without being a static aerial target. Ajax, Neptune, and two of the destroyers would then head to Malta to continue the rotating operation generally, operating alongside Force K from the Grand Harbour, the rest of the ships both being needed back with the main fleet in Alexandria, and collectively representing far too much of a strain on Malta's fuel and ammunition reserves. At the end of November 1941, while all this was underway, the main fleet did put to sea in order to provide cover for the operations off of Benghazi if the Regia Marina had tried to interfere with them. But unfortunately, a U-boat managed to get through the destroyer screen and put three torpedoes into HMS Barham, which rolled over, exploded, and sank in a matter of minutes. The small Axis convoys that were intercepted during the period were scant compensation for the loss of the battleship or the loss of the many lives aboard her. Cunningham ordered the submarine HMS Otis to be taken off frontline duties for a while, and she was ordered to provide a live target for intensive anti-submarine warfare training across the fleet. Forces K and B would continue to have a good measure of success against Axis convoys in early December, but increasing numbers of Luftwaffe aircraft, along with the loss of the cruiser Neptune and the destroyer Kandahar to an enemy minefield later in the month, led to both forces eventually being recalled to Alexandria, except for the cruiser Penelope, which was under repairs after many near misses had riddled her hull, and which would then fight an ongoing battle in the Malta dockyards over the next little while, as the dock workers and her crew did their best to patch her up, and the Luftwaffe and the Regia Aeronautica did their best to put new and interesting holes in the ship. Given the increased submarine threat, the South African government agreed to keep the 22nd South African Anti-Submarine Group with the fleet for a little bit longer, as the four ships of that group had been due to go home at the end of the year. Finally, the land offensive got some momentum going, and in early December, Tobruk was finally relieved. Cunningham totalled up the naval contribution to Tobruk over the past months. Just over 34,000 troops, 7,500 wounded, and just over 7,000 prisoners of war had been evacuated, with just over 32,500 troops, 92 artillery pieces, 34,000 tons of supplies, 72 tanks, and, weirdly enough, 108 sheep being ferried in. At the cost of 467 sailors killed or missing, another 186 wounded, and the loss of two destroyers, three sloops, and 22 other vessels, with another 27, including seven destroyers, damaged, and six merchant ships sunk and another six damaged. But even as all this occurred, word reached the Mediterranean fleet that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor and begun a general offensive across the Pacific. This resulted in a confused rush of shipping, as some ships were taken from the Mediterranean fleet and hurried east. Other ships showed up to replace them, some permanent and some temporary. But the main takeaway for Cunningham with all of this was that it was very unlikely he was going to receive any aircraft carriers anytime soon, as those that were working up or repairing from damage were earmarked for the Eastern Fleet. But the fact he wasn't getting any heavy reinforcements didn't mean there was going to be any let-up in the action. A few days later, four destroyers, the Sikh, Maori, Legion, and the Dutch Isaac Spheres, intercepted an Italian fast resupply convoy that was made up of two light cruisers and a small destroyer. Thanks to their excellent night fighting skills, the British destroyers snuck in close and opened up with guns and torpedoes, sinking both of the Italian cruisers, whose decks were covered in, amongst other things, lots of barrels of petrol, which certainly didn't help matters when the destroyers' anti-aircraft gunners began to rake their targets with pom-pom rounds, sending up massive fireballs as the petrol cargo exploded. In fact, mid-December was a whirlwind of engagements across the sea. British submarines went on something of a killing spree, but this was balanced by an Axis submarine managing to sink the light cruiser Galatea in return, while Admiral Vian was trying to get the Breconshire, a merchant ship converted into a sort of tanker, and its precious cargo of various fuels into Malta. He had three light cruisers and seven destroyers with him, with Cunningham ordering two more cruisers and six destroyers to come out from Malta to help. At this stage, the Malta surface forces had yet to be withdrawn. That was for the future. But Vian's forces were spotted by Regia Aeronautica recon aircraft, and soon a large Regia Marina force was reported to be heading in their direction. All nearby ships were ordered to head for Vian's position, but with so many destroyers already committed to the operation and out on escort duty, Cunningham's battleships ended up being left stranded in Alexandria as they lacked the escort to safely go to sea, given the number of submarines recently operating in the area and the loss of Barham. Vian was charged with first protecting the precious tanker and then attacking the enemy fleet with torpedoes. This left Vian with a rather daunting task, as his total force now amounted to 5 light cruisers and 14 destroyers, but the Italian forces, which it turned out were also in the process of covering a convoy of their own, consisted of 4 battleships, Littorio, Andrea Doria, Giulio Cesare and Duilio, 2 heavy cruisers, 3 light cruisers and 13 destroyers. But luck was on his side. A decoy operation by HMS Abdiel and a Regia Aeronautica spotter who presumably had lost his glasses at some point when he was staring at Breconshire, resulted in the Regia Mariner being convinced that those 2 vessels were in fact battleships, and this made them far more cautious than they otherwise could really have been. This allowed Vian to get Breconshire off to safety before turning his force to engage as evening fell. Wary of British night fighting skills, the Italian forces then fell back with the coming of the darkness, ending the First Battle of Cirte with only 2 British destroyers having been damaged by near misses from long-range Italian gunfire. But this success was soon to be overshadowed by 2 rather major disasters. Force B running into a minefield, as we described earlier, with the loss of Neptune and Kandahar, and then 2 days later, at about 4 in the morning on December the 19th, Cunningham was woken in his cabin aboard the battleship HMS Queen Elizabeth by the news that a pair of Italians had been found holding onto the buoy that marked the forward mooring point for the battleship Valiant. Suspecting the worst, when the 2 men refused to provide any answers as to what they were doing, Cunningham ordered them to be confined below the waterline on Valiant, and had the crews of both ships called into action. Small charges were ordered to be dropped into the water in case there happened to be more enemy divers around, and chain lines were rigged to be dragged across the ship's undersides to try and dislodge any limpet mines. Unfortunately, although the Italian Special Forces had actually intended to attach limpet mines, they'd experienced problems in doing so, and thus they laid their charges on the seabed beneath Valiant and suspended from the bilge keels of Queen Elizabeth. As such, the chain drag achieved nothing, and at about 6 in the morning, an explosion occurred under the stern of the tanker Sagona, where another charge had been laid by a 3rd team, damaging that ship and the destroyer Jervis, which was alongside. Around about that time, the Italians had asked to come up from the hold of HMS Valiant and explained that the ship was going to explode soon. They'd obviously been rather nervous about being below the waterline in a ship that they themselves had mined. And about 20 minutes after the explosion under the Sagona, the charge underneath the Valiant exploded, and 4 minutes later the one under Queen Elizabeth went off as well. Cunningham was, at that point, right at the aft end of Queen Elizabeth and found himself flung about 5 feet in the air. He considered himself lucky to have come back down on the ship's deck instead of being flung overboard. Damage control efforts rapidly went into effect, and as a result, neither ship was technically speaking sunk. Although both were crippled, they still had water under their keels, even if those keels were somewhat lower in the water than previously. With Warspite off being repaired in the United States and the loss of Barham, this meant that the heaviest intact and operational vessel in the Mediterranean fleet was now a small light cruiser. To try and avoid giving away the situation, Cunningham ordered life aboard the ships to continue as normal, with careful counter-flooding bringing the ships back on an even, if somewhat deeper, keel, which hopefully gave the impression that all was well. Of course, temporary repairs would have to be organised, and both ships would end up being out of action for rather prolonged periods, although it was discovered that after some quick repairs in a floating dry dock at the end of the month, Valiant was, at least in theory, capable of sailing in an emergency, whereas Queen Elizabeth, whose explosion had been closer to midships, was in much more trouble. To cap it all off, while the offensive on land had captured Benghazi, it turned out that in addition to Axis last-minute demolition efforts, the combination of Allied naval and air attacks had done such a good job of wrecking it over the past few months that it was now rather hard to get supplies into the port to support the Allied armies, something that the Axis had also been experiencing. The supply lines for said Allied armies were now, of course, much longer, and German and Italian submarines were hitting the supply convoys constantly. But there was a small bright spot to be had. The intensive anti-submarine warfare training that had been perpetuated by the loss of Barham now resulted in a number of enemy submarines being sunk and others damaged in exchange for their attacks on the convoys, which eased pressure from that quarter for a little while. This all meant that as 1942 dawned, Cunningham's options for offensive action were limited to hit enemy convoys at night, and if the Italian battle fleet sailed, there was precious little that could be done to actually stop them. Although the Regia Marina didn't stir in strength during January, which allowed more supplies to reach Malta, the Axis counterattack in the desert meant that supplying Benghazi wasn't a problem for anyone anymore, as it fell back into Axis hands by the end of the month. Cunningham noted with some annoyance that the evacuation order came just days after they'd finally managed to get the port operational again. While the supply lines for moving men and material for the army were now shorter, it also meant the brief period in which coastal airfields had been able to provide cover for almost the entire run to Malta was over, and enemy aircraft would now make that last 200 miles a daunting gauntlet of Regia Aeronautica and Luftwaffe attackers. Some help was accomplished for Malta by using large submarines to supply it, but of course these were limited when it came to the transport of bulk goods like fuel oil or food. In the middle of February, an attempt to get a convoy through saw two of the transports sunk and another crippled and forced to withdraw, which meant that no supply ships made it to their intended destination. The Mediterranean fleet also continued to be depleted. Abdiel was recalled home, six destroyers and three submarines were sent to the Eastern Fleet, and another two left for repairs. Three more destroyers would be sunk or damaged by air attack in the opening months of 1942, leaving most of the offensive action to an eclectic mixture of submarines which were available. Nonetheless, these vessels took to the task with a will, their crews receiving a number of Victoria Crosses for various actions, and the recipients actually, rarely for a Victoria Cross, survived their relevant deeds. Small reinforcements came in the form of the old cruiser Cleopatra and the destroyer Kingston, both of which had made it to Malta from the west, but the operation to extract them safely to Alexandria saw the modern anti-aircraft cruiser Naiad sunk by a submarine torpedo, which largely neutered the overall effect of the reinforcements. In late March, another convoy of four merchant ships, including the Breconshire, was organised to try and reach Malta once again. With four light cruisers and 10 destroyers, representing almost the entire remaining Mediterranean fleet's surface strength, going with them, joined by a half-flotilla of Hunt-class escort destroyers, whose 4-inch dual-purpose batteries would prove highly useful in the anti-aircraft role. One more cruiser and one destroyer made the run out of Malta to come and help, but soon enemy aerial reconnaissance appeared, and on the first day, 150 enemy aircraft attacked, along with reports of a major surface force deploying from Italy. Vian was once more in local command, and his plan, if the enemy battle fleet showed up, was for every single ship to make smoke, thus blanketing the convoy, and then use radar and radio to coordinate within the smoke, and then they'd all charge headlong out of the smoke, that is the warships, in a mass do-or-die attack against an enemy that would probably outnumber them about 3-1, as well as including multiple heavy cruisers and battleships. As it turned out, the Italians did in fact show up, with the battleship Littorio, a pair of heavy cruisers, a light cruiser and 10 destroyers, massively outgunning the British in every single department except for destroyers. When the first Italian formation, the cruisers and four of their destroyers, appeared, Vian ordered the Hunt-class escort destroyers to take the convoy south while the fleet destroyers and the cruisers charged. He'd already organised his major surface warships into mutually supporting divisions, so it was much easier to organise than sending orders to every single ship. After a brief exchange of gunfire, the Italian formation drew away to both exploit the fact they had a range advantage and to lure Vian onto the guns of Littorio and away from the convoy, which was now under attack by a considerable number of aircraft. Quickly adapting his plan, Vian's ships put up a massive smoke barrier and then hid in it, forcing the Italians into an extended game of naval whack-a-mole. As without radar, the Regia Marina forces didn't dare get too close to the giant smoke cloud for risk of getting torpedoed, while the British ships used their radar to pre-sight their guns, pop out of the smoke to double-check and refine their fire control solution using their optical systems, fire off a few salvos, and then duck back into the smoke as the Italian ship's return fire started to gain the range. A number of British ships would be hit by either splinters or the occasional shell, but none would be sunk or permanently disabled. A few made daring runs far from the smoke in order to get close enough to send volleys of torpedoes downrange, which forced the bolder Italian ships into evasive action. Just before 7 in the evening, one of the destroyers even landed a 4.7-inch shell hit on Littorio. It didn't do anything significant, of course, but it did illustrate just how close the ranges managed to get at times. Once again, night was closing in, and with it came a gale. And once again, not wanting to chance the British closing in with torpedoes in the darkness, the Italians decided to call it a day and withdraw, thus ending the Second Battle of Cirte. But the convoy was not out of danger yet. Most of Vian's escorts now had to fall back to Alexandria to refuel as they'd been charging around at full speed most of the day. The original plan had been for the convoy to make the run into Malta through the area of greatest danger at night, arriving in the Grand Harbour at dawn. But with the southern detour to avoid the Italian battle formation, it meant they were taking a longer route, and thus, at first light the next day, with the Hunt-class vessels and the anti-aircraft cruiser Carlisle being the main remaining guardians, they were still some distance from Malta. All the escorts were running somewhat low on ammunition, and the decision was made to split the convoy a bit, so a massed attack on one transport didn't afford opportunity attacks on the others. Inevitably, in the dark, the ships drifted still further apart, and although the Talabot and Pampas made it to Malta, the Clan Campbell took a bomb hit to the engine room and sank 50 miles out, while poor old Breconshire, which had more successful Malta runs than almost any other ship, was crippled just 8 miles from safety. Rescue efforts mounted for both vessels cost the destroyer Southwold sunk and the Legion damaged and forced to run aground as enemy aircraft tried to finish the job. Eventually, a tug got Breconshire into one of Malta's southeastern harbours, where she was bombed again a few days later, rolled over, and sank. Although her time afloat was done, her final mission wasn't to be in vain, as salvage workers would then drill into her tanks from the exposed underside and manage to retrieve most of her vital cargo of fuel. The two transports which had made it into the harbour would also be hit in subsequent bombing raids, limiting the amount of supplies that were successfully recovered from them. These raids also compounded damage to the destroyers Legion and Kingston, leaving both damaged beyond repair. And elsewhere, a submarine managed to get the destroyer Jaguar. Thus, although the Italian fleet had failed to engage the convoy directly itself, it did in many ways facilitate a significant reduction of the supplies that actually arrived and were recovered in Malta. The losses to the transports and the warships meant that for the moment Malta's lifeline would consist solely of 5 submarines and the Abdiel-class HMS Welshman. The Mediterranean fleet simply didn't have that much more left to give. For Cunningham himself, change was also in the wind. Although he wanted to stick it out with the Mediterranean fleet, he was ordered to prepare for a trip to Washington, D.C. He was to be the Royal Navy's representative on the Allied Combined Chiefs of Staff. He had to keep his departure secret, which annoyed him as he would rather have liked to visit his various ships and their crews. But instead, he left messages to be read to the fleet once the embargo on discussing his whereabouts was lifted, which read in part, "This achievement of the officers and men of the Mediterranean fleet in some 2 years of the most strenuous naval fighting on record is one which I greatly treasure, as greatly as I do the privilege of having led the fleet during that period. The enemy knows we are his master on the sea, and we must strain every nerve to keep our standard of fighting so high that this lesson never fails to be borne in upon him. Our worldwide commitments at present mean that we have not at times as large forces as we would like to carry the war to the enemy's front door. This will not always be so, and I look forward to the day when the Mediterranean fleet will sweep the sea clear and re-establish an age-old control of this waterway so vital to the British Empire. I am confident that day is not far distant, and meanwhile I wish you all good fortune and Godspeed." That latter section was to prove to be prophetic, and it was something that he would have no small hand in making coming about. His route back home was circuitous. He and his wife first had to fly down to Khartoum, then across Africa to Sierra Leone, then up to Lisbon, and finally to Bristol, where he swapped the eclectic mix of flying boats and transport planes for a train, which he then took to London. Although initially tabled for only a couple of weeks in London before heading over the Atlantic, various complications ensued, mostly to do with the means of transport, and it wouldn't be until late June that they finally set off, having left Alexandria in early April. During the extended stay in the UK, Cunningham was informed that he was to be made a baronet and a Knight Grand Cross of the Order of the Bath. Initially, he was tempted to politely refuse the honours, as he put no particular great store in titles, and considerably more store in achieving results. But the First Sea Lord pointed out that Cunningham represented the Mediterranean Fleet's accomplishments to date in the war in the shape of one man, and his reward would be seen by the men of the fleet as recognition of their own achievements, since of course you don't grant titles like this to a man who had led a fleet that performed poorly. And thus Cunningham chose to accept. After a 25-hour non-stop plane flight to New York, it was right onto another plane to head to Washington, where he was flung headlong into the upper echelons of Allied military planning, having to get familiar with the US President, Admiral King, General Marshall, and various others, all in a very short period of time. To the mild astonishment of many other British officers there, Cunningham figured out how to deal with Admiral King in the space of a few weeks. He observed later that King was generally not content with fighting the enemy. He was usually fighting someone on his own side as well. But after a fortnight of escalating tensions, he delivered what he described as straight speaking to King in an argument over submarine deployment. I'll leave it to your imagination what straight speaking means, coming from a veteran British naval officer. But in any case, after that day, the two became firm friends. The trick apparently being, stand your ground and don't pull any punches with saying what you thought about either King or his plans. It probably helped that Cunningham regularly weighed in on the side of the United States Navy in a series of apparently very acrimonious disputes between them and the Army over various matters. It has to be borne out, this is mid-1942 and they're still learning quite a bit about actually being at war. In particular, at this point, the US Army Air Force was demanding full control over the anti-submarine warfare aircraft based along the US coast, who were themselves struggling to deal with a U-boat offensive, to the point that they even demanded operational control of an RAF Coastal Command squadron of Hudsons that had been sent over to help train US pilots in the most effective ways of hunting German submarines. Cunningham was quite firm in his opinion that whoever wanted the shiny title of notional command of the Eastern Seaboard's anti-submarine hunting capabilities, the coastal efforts should be under the overall auspices of the Navy, which won him a great many friends in the US Navy, unsurprisingly. What was a rather tougher sell was what to do next in Europe. Many in the US Navy wanted to focus mainly or entirely on Japan, and if they absolutely had to send major forces to Europe, they thought they should just go straight at northern France. Selling them on Operation Torch was therefore quite difficult. And there was also a matter of how the naval element of any operation should be conducted wherever it happened to go. The three main options put forward for discussion were thus. 1. A naval commander-in-chief who answered only to the supreme commander and mostly worked with rather than for him. 2. A naval officer with overall responsibility for seaborne matters, but with a considerably lower rank than the supreme commander, who would therefore order him about as a subordinate. And 3. A higher-ranking naval officer, but instead of representing the naval side as its own thing, they would be on the staff of the Supreme Commander as one of many officers in that organisation. Cunningham was of the opinion that option 1 was the only really viable option due to the massive difference in knowledge required to command the seas as opposed to the land, since Eisenhower was already being prepared as Supreme Commander and he was of course an army officer. The second option ran the risk of the naval forces being ordered to do things that were just physically impossible, in part due to ignorance on the part of the one giving the orders, and the third option meant that the naval voice might be lost in general discussion. Eventually, a consensus emerged that Operation Torch would in fact be put into action, and that a naval commander-in-chief would be appointed. And, of course, approximately one plank moment later, half a dozen officials from both the US and the UK were asking Cunningham if he'd be up for the job of Naval Commander-in-Chief. It quickly became clear that this was more of polite advanced notice than a genuine inquiry as to whether or not he actually wanted the job. And so over the summer, Cunningham found himself working on the naval side of Allied grand strategy before he was actually officially told that he had the job. He also developed a rather cunning way of dealing with the American press. He and Admiral King were often called in for conferences with the US president, and there was usually a mob of reporters waiting for people to emerge. Cunningham quickly worked out that the best thing to do was to be the first to leave, tell the reporters that Admiral King would be out shortly and he would tell them everything, and then hightail it to the nearest car or taxi. Admiral King would then, of course, emerge, say nothing, and barely even acknowledge the existence of the press as he marched his way out to his own destination. After a quick visit to the UK in late September, Cunningham returned to the United States for a few weeks, and then in mid-October he boarded a bomber heading back to Europe. When he'd left the Mediterranean, his command had amounted to basically a single cruiser squadron and a couple of destroyer flotillas, as well as a broken battleship that was awaiting repairs. Now he was in overall command of a force where just its western formation included three battleships, seven cruisers, a fleet carrier, four escort carriers, and several dozen destroyers. This was made up of American ships, as it was hoped that the Vichy French forces might react a bit more favourably to them than the Royal Navy. Meanwhile, the central and eastern formations were each made up of British vessels, with each group being about the size of the Mediterranean fleet as it had been when Cunningham had left them. Plus, they had some escort carriers. And then, of course, there was the covering force. Gone were the days of dancing back and forth through smoke if the Regia Marina turned up. Now, Cunningham positively hoped that they'd put in an appearance, as this force consisted of three fleet carriers, the battleships Duke of York, Rodney and Nelson, the battlecruiser Renown, three cruisers, and 17 destroyers. It was time to take the fight back to the Axis in a rather large way.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.